The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello, and welcome. Sadly, Alex is on a work trip this week, so it's just going to be me. But if you miss Alex, you can hear him and I talking about a lot of things over on Patreon. Bonus episode number 48 just came out over there last week, and we're chatting about scuba divers that got left in the ocean when the boat they were with couldn't find them in the water. And then they ended up on an island with Komodo dragons. And if you know anything about Komodo dragons, you know that's really bad and very terrifying. So if you want to hear that episode and a ton of others, head over there. But today I'm going to be telling you a story that is unbelievable in so many ways and truly heartbreaking. I have so much to say, so why don't we just get right into it? Listener discretion is advised. Jesse Blodgett was born in 1994 to parents Joy and Buck Blodgett in Atlanta, Georgia, although they eventually moved to Hartford, Wisconsin, which is just outside of Milwaukee. Hartford was a community of roughly 16,000 people and was a great place for Jesse to grow up because it was a safe area and had a vibrant art scene. Jesse was extremely gifted from a very young age. She was always a top student in her class. For instance, in the first grade, when Jesse and her classmates were learning to spell, Jesse's teachers needed to make her own list with more complex words because she was so ahead of all the other kids. She was also gifted musically. She began playing piano in the first grade, and her father Buck began taking lessons with her because he thought he'd have to do it alongside her to keep her into it, but she very quickly surpassed him, so he dropped out. And from then on, music became her ultimate passion. It was a way for her to express herself. She also played the violin along with the piano, she sang, and she began writing her own music. Most of all, she loved to entertain. She even won the 8th grade talent show with a song that she wrote, which was the first time anyone had heard any of her original music. In high school, Jessie was in the concert choir. She also did the orchestra and the musicals, which is what drew a lot of her friends to her. She was really bright and had a ton of energy and passion and was just a really good kid. She was also really close with her father growing up. Buck said they'd talk about everything. It was never an issue pulling anything out of her. Sometimes he couldn't shut her up. She felt free to talk about anything with him, and most of all, things that mattered. Her friends called her wise beyond her years. According to her father, she was the kind of kid that chastised the smokers and drinkers at parties. She had a great inner strength and belief. And she had a really close group of friends. They would all hang out at the local coffee shop, Perk Place, after school and do homework together. But above pretty much anything else, music was the most important thing to Jessie. So during her freshman year of college at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, she auditioned for the music program, and she got in. Her dream was to become a music teacher and to change the world through music. She was really happy and on her way to living her dream. During the summer of 2013, Jessie Blodgett was 19 years old and living at home with her parents. She had just finished up her freshman year of college and was spending the summer teaching music lessons. She had started her own business and had 28 students, mostly kids, come into her house for piano, voice, and violin lessons. She had also auditioned to be in the local production of Fiddler on the Roof and had gotten the role of the fiddler, which she was really excited about. In that role, she'd get to play the violin, which was something she was always amazing at, and her father was so proud of her for getting the title role. The morning of Monday, July 15th, was Jessie's first morning that summer to sleep in. Fiddler on the Roof had just had their opening weekend and had their cast party that Sunday night, so Monday morning, Jessie would have been exhausted. It was a typical morning for Jessie's mom, Joy. Before work, she had walked into her daughter's room to drop off some laundry before leaving, and a few hours later, Joy came home for lunch. She called upstairs for Jessie to let her know she was home, but got no answer. She didn't think much of it, so she called upstairs again. She then looked out the window while she was eating a quick lunch and saw one of Jessie's 6-year-old students and her father walking up the driveway. So Joy called upstairs again to tell Jessie that her lesson was here, but still she got no answer. So Joy ran upstairs to see what was taking her daughter so long. When she opened Jessie's bedroom door, she found her asleep in bed. She walked over to her and reached out to wake her up. But when she felt Jessie, Joy felt that she was cold to the touch, and she noticed that Jessie didn't look okay. She looked blue. Jessie wasn't responsive at all, and that was when Joy called 911. That day, Buck got the phone call that every parent fears. His wife told him that the EMTs were there, and Jessie wasn't responding. Buck couldn't bring himself to say it, so he asked his wife if Jessie was gone, and tragically, she was. Jessie's friends and neighbors saw police activity outside her house, so they tried calling and texting her, but couldn't get a hold of anyone. Detective Jim Zawicki of the Hartford Police Department was on the scene that day. He had gotten a call about a suspicious death of a young person in the community, which was not something they heard every day. When he arrived, he checked all the entry points of the house for any signs of forced entry, which he didn't find. Jessie was found in her bedroom, which apparently appeared to be a normal young lady's room. Nothing stuck out as weird. When police got there, Jessie was laying on the floor because her mother had moved her to perform CPR as instructed by the 911 dispatcher, but her mother had found Jessie tucked into her bed. Detective Zawicki immediately noticed from the way her head was tilted that she had faint ligature marks on the side of her neck. He could also tell that the pressure from the ligature marks had been applied from the back, which was something she couldn't have done herself. There was also faint bruising on the wrists and ankles, which suggested her hands and ankles had been bound together. This appeared to not only be a murder, but an intimate one. Strangulation is a more intimate way to kill someone, which was also supported by the fact that this person came into Jessie's house seemingly without forcing their way in to murder her in that way. So as Lieutenant Zawicki looked over the room to find the murder weapon, he found extension cords plugged in, as well as the string pull from the shades. But none of those items he found in her room matched the marks on her neck. They found some blood evidence on the sheets and pillowcase, but no sign of a struggle, no ransacking. And when he first showed up, he noticed on the piano outside her room, there was cash sitting in plain sight right on top, which meant this wasn't a robbery. This scene seemed staged. The way Jessie's mother had found her suggested she had been intentionally placed in bed to appear as if she was asleep. She was neatly tucked into bed. It was intimate and intentional. Detectives also learned from conversations with Jessie's mother that Jessie's hair and pants were wet in bed when she found her. It appeared she had been bathed before she was put in bed, which was extremely strange. When Jessie's murder hit the news, the community of Hartford began to panic. Homicides were very rare in the city of Hartford, and now there was a dangerous person out there who was free. No one knew who had killed her or what had happened. Friends of hers were terrified because everyone loved Jessie. No one could have imagined anything like this happening. Once Buck and Joy realized that someone had intentionally taken Jessie's life, they started brainstorming who could have been responsible. Police had been canvassing the area to see if neighbors had any useful information or had seen anything, but nobody had.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Jesse's parents did have some thoughts about who could have done this. The guys who trimmed their trees immediately came to mind, because they had been in the trees directly over Jesse's bedroom only a week prior. And when they had come to trim the trees, they were there in the morning as Jesse would have been sleeping. So they very easily could have seen into her room and saw a 19-year-old girl asleep in bed. And police agreed that was a potential lead. The tree trimmers would have not only been in the trees over her room, but they would have been working there for a few days, which meant they could have picked up on a routine, like when Joy and Buck left for work and when Jesse would be in the house alone. But when police interviewed the tree trimmers, they were able to determine that none of them had been responsible. But Buck had another concern. There was a creepy guy at Jesse's job. She was a waitress at a restaurant in their neighborhood, and an older man had positioned himself in a narrow hallway in a way that the waitresses had to come into contact with him when they went past him, which is disgusting. So detectives looked into this guy as well, but they were able to determine that this guy wasn't even in the area the day Jesse was murdered. He was a creep, but he was not responsible for Jesse's murder. The crime lab had been conducting a rape analysis, but those results typically take a while to come back. So in the meantime, police were trying to piece together a timeline of the murder and of Jesse's final days. So police did a full workup on Jesse's life. They spoke to her friends and family. They found out things like who she knew, where she worked, what type of person she was. And what they discovered was that Jesse was an amazing person, and she was doing everything right in life. She seemingly had no enemies. Everyone that talked to police had nothing but good things to say about her. She was a kind girl, she worked hard, she was passionate, she was loving and caring, and nobody could understand how this happened to someone like Jesse, of all people. Jesse obviously had a very close-knit group of friends, but she also was in this musical, and many of the people that she was working with in the musical she had only really known for the 6 weeks that she had been in rehearsals with them. So there was potential that the conflict could have come from one of these people who was fairly new to her life. So police began looking at what Jesse was doing day to day and if there had been any conflict. Police talked to Jerry Becker, the director of Fiddler on the Roof, and asked him if there were any issues in the cast that he knew about, like potential jealousy or anything that could have led anyone to harming Jesse. He told them that from night one of Fiddler on the Roof, Jesse stuck out. She had an infectious energy and everyone loved her. There was no conflict that he knew about going on in the cast. But police believed this could have been a targeted attack. Whoever had done this knew their way around the Blodgett household and knew where Jesse's bedroom was. So Friday and Saturday evening, the cast had performed, as well as doing a Sunday matinee. And then Sunday evening, they had their cast party that went late into the night. Police determined that Jessie had been killed on Monday morning because when police had gotten on the scene, her body was still warm and rigor mortis hadn't set in yet. The cast party on Sunday night was on this big farm with a pool, so people were swimming and having chicken fights and hanging out around a fire pit. And Jessie seemed to be having a great time. She's seen in a picture sitting next to her director for a time, having a conversation about how much fun she was having in the show and how happy she was, which made her director so happy to know that this girl in his cast, who he didn't know previously, was having such a good time in his show. It warmed his heart. He loved it. And all the kids were having a great time. Everyone there said that the party was awesome. But that night when Jessie got home, her mood had shifted. She had gotten home really late and was a little bit troubled. Joy was awake at the time, so she asked Jessie how the party was, and Jessie told her that she was a little bit uncomfortable with a guy from the cast who was a considerable amount older than her, who had been a bit too flirtatious with her. Police had also found Jessie's diary that had been sitting next to her bed, which included an entry from only a few hours before she would have been murdered. So she came home from the cast party, she told her mother she was uncomfortable with something that had happened, and then she wrote a diary entry before going to sleep that night. She wrote about her experience that night and that there was someone in the cast that she was really upset with. She wrote, quote, "I think I'm being corrupted. I think certain men are taking what should be platonic love and perverting it into a competition. In a way, I'm furious." She also included the cast member's name in her diary, which was Randy Talley. So investigators had a name. Randy was the choreographer for the show and also played a leading role. At the cast party, Jessie was seen by her cast members sitting in Randy's lap around a fire. He was 46 years old and Jessie was 19. Some of her friends in the cast also felt uncomfortable with it because they didn't know if Jessie was okay with this arrangement. It wasn't just that Jessie had been sitting in his lap. Her friends had seen him pull her into his lap, so it was a little unclear if this was welcomed by Jessie. They had been smiling and talking and whatever, so it didn't seem like it was immediately alarming, but that didn't necessarily mean that this was wanted by Jessie and she didn't feel uncomfortable with the situation. Because I can imagine at 19 years old, and especially with a guy who's that much older than you, you're at a situation where you're at a cast party with all these new friends and you get pulled into the lap of this guy. It wouldn't be crazy for this young girl to not want to cause a scene and immediately freak out and stand up and be like, "You're a jerk, don't pull me into your lap." She might just sit in his lap and feel uncomfortable because that's kind of easier to do sometimes. So her friends couldn't quite tell what the situation was because on one hand, they're like, listen, she's an adult. She can choose whatever she wants to do. If she is interested in him, then that's fine to them. But they also understood that he was significantly older than her and there was a very high possibility that Jessie was not happy with the situation. And as it turned out, Jessie wasn't quite happy with the situation because she went home and she wrote about it in her diary. When the cast at her community theater learned about Jessie's murder, they felt her loss in a very big way. And also, before anything was figured out, her castmates were scared because they didn't know if the person responsible was potentially in their show. And because Randy Talley was mentioned by name in Jessie's diary as someone who made her feel uncomfortable only the night before, police brought him in for questioning. He had also been one of the last people to see her alive, so they wanted to speak with him anyway. And right off the bat, there were a few red flags in this interview. When police brought him in, their first order of business was figuring out where he was at the time of Jessie's murder. And Randy didn't have a great alibi. He wasn't working that morning. He had a temp job, and his job apparently tried to call him in, but they had gotten the wrong number, so they didn't get a hold of him until after the end of the workday. So he had just been at home. Police asked him about his time at the cast party, which he said was great. They were swimming and talking, and he sat and talked with Jessie for most of the night. Police wanted to know how they were sitting together, and he said they were sitting on a couch, hip to hip, and he may have touched her back, she may have touched his leg, they had some minor contact. Randy said he didn't get the impression that anything was wrong. They had the best night together. And police told him they knew he and Jessie had been flirting a little bit, which he didn't deny. When they brought up him pulling her onto his lap, he said he had. She was, quote-unquote, one of his favorite people in the cast. But it never went any further than that. She was someone he felt very close with, but they never kissed or anything further than what people saw. He told police he had a long-term girlfriend. Which is crazy, because he's pulling a 19-year-old girl onto his lap and flirting with her at a cast party, which is gross in itself. So the police were like, I'm sure your girlfriend wouldn't like that, would they? And he said he was a quote-unquote demonstrably affectionate person, which apparently made his flirting with a 19-year-old and pulling her onto his lap totally okay to him. He did say, oh, she probably wouldn't like it, but I'm not ashamed of it. The whole thing's a little weird. Since he had physical contact with Jesse in the last few days, they asked Randy for a DNA sample, and he did agree to give them a sample. And then they let him sit there in the interview room for a few minutes before they went back in to question him some more. They kind of wanted to let him sweat a little bit. But finally, the detective came back and told Randy he felt like Randy had more insight than he was leading on. And Randy told them he really didn't. He wished he had more insight for them, but he didn't. Detectives just wanted to know if he hadn't gone to work that Monday morning, what had he been doing? Randy told them he slept in. He Facebook messaged some friends, he sent out a few resumes, and he hung out around the house. When police asked him why specifically Jesse may have written in her diary about feeling uncomfortable with him, he said he was a hugger. He had known Jesse for 6 weeks, and he felt very close to her. But other than that, he didn't know. They had never had any arguments or anything weird happen, other than him pushing 50 and flirting with a teenager. But I digress. Jerry Becker, the director, said he didn't know Randy very well, but he never saw anything that caused him concern. Like, he wasn't an unsafe person for all these young people to be around. If he ever thought that Randy was unsafe, he wouldn't have had him there. And Randy told police he had never been to Jesse's house, and he didn't even know where she lived. He was also asked if he committed the homicide, and he adamantly denied that he had any involvement in it. But detectives weren't so sure, because Randy still didn't really have a solid alibi. So investigators pulled his phone records, and by tracking his movements, they were able to determine it would have been impossible for Randy to be at Jesse's home the morning she was murdered. So because of that, he was ruled out as a suspect, which brought the investigation back to square one. What police didn't know was 3 days before Jesse's murder, there had been another attack at a park only a few towns over that almost cost a young woman her life. Washington County Sheriff's Office was investigating that crime at the same time Hartford police were looking into Jesse's case, but they didn't know that they had any link to each other. On July 12, 2013, Melissa Etzler was walking her dog Remy in Richfield Historical Park when she noticed there was only one other person in the park at the time. He was sitting in his van when she looked over at him, which she didn't think was odd. It was a public park, after all. She had noticed when she made eye contact with him that he tilted his head back in his seat so she couldn't see him anymore, which was a little bit weird, but it was possible he just wasn't feeling like having someone look at him. And I get that. You don't really want to have someone looking at you while you're sitting in your car. But also, if someone makes awkward eye contact with you, you just kind of avert your eyes. You don't necessarily yeet your head back. That's a little strange. So Melissa walked her dog in the park, and as she was finishing their walk, she was headed back to her car when she heard someone approaching her. She turned around to find a guy running straight toward her. Melissa at first didn't realize that she was in any danger. She said, "Oh, you scared me." But it sunk in that something was wrong when the guy didn't stop running at her. And that was when she saw the knife in his hand. It all happened very fast. This guy tackled Melissa, and as she went to the ground, she managed to grab the blade of the knife and would not let go. She screamed at him, "What are you doing?" She said her body just reacted. She didn't even have time to feel any pain. She had so much adrenaline. She had a grip on the blade and she wasn't going to let go. Melissa's dog was with her, but Remy had just turned a year old, so she wasn't a guard dog by any means. She was just standing there confused. And since Melissa wasn't letting go of the knife, the attacker took off running back to his van and drove away. Melissa got into her car, threw the knife on the ground, and peeled out of there as well. Her first call was to her new boyfriend at the time, Joel Etzler. And as she told him what just happened, she was bleeding all over her car from the gash in her hand and from the cuts all on her leg. Joel told her to go to his parents' house, which was where they called 911. In their area, there was very little stranger-on-stranger crime. So at first, police didn't entirely believe Melissa's story. It seemed so strange that some random man would run up to her out of nowhere with a knife and attack her. But when Detective Joel Clausing got to the hospital and talked to Melissa, he immediately saw that she was distraught. But at the same time, she was very clear about what had happened. Something very strange about the attack was when the guy attacked Melissa and she grabbed the knife, he asked her, "Can I go?" which came off very weak and scared and almost confused, according to her, which Melissa said no to. He tried grabbing the knife away from her, but she told him if he was gonna go, she was taking the knife with her. And that was when he let go of the knife and ran back to his car. What a badass. Think about how fast this all happened. She's just walking her dog in the park, and some guy sprints up to her with a knife in hand, tackles her to the ground, and she grabs the blade of the knife, and then she won't let go. And the guy asks her, "Can I go?" And she says, "No." She was like, "If you're gonna go, I'm taking this knife because I want evidence," basically. She's like, "You're not gonna attack me and take this and get away with it. Like, I'm taking this as evidence, you piece of shit." And he got scared and he ran. It was such a strange attack. Police questioned and cleared Melissa's boyfriend because at first they're like, okay, this is so strange that all of this has happened. There's no way it could be from a stranger, so maybe it's your boyfriend. But then they questioned the boyfriend and they're like, okay, it's not you. But then they determined that the story she was telling was in fact true for one particular reason. She claimed when he tackled her to the ground, she had been on her stomach and he was on top of her. And detectives saw that the tops of her shoes were covered in gravel dust, which absolutely checked out for what she said happened. The only way you get gravel dust on the tops of your shoes is if you're face down on the ground. So they were like, okay, wow, yeah, this really happened to you. So Melissa gave a description of the guy who had attacked her. She said he was white, blonde, he had black framed glasses, he had kind of a bowl haircut, and she gave so many details that they were able to come up with an incredible composite sketch. Detective Joel Clausing said to this day, she is one of the better witnesses he's ever talked to. She remembered so much. Which Melissa says is thanks to her interest in true crime. She watches a lot of crime shows, and because of that, she said she remembered so much and it helped her through the attack. She's just like me for real. Which is a joke. She's more of a badass, obviously. But I do always think about, like, okay, I've listened to so many true crime stories and I've obviously now told so many true crime stories. Like, would my knowledge of these attacks potentially help me in a situation like this? And like, yeah, maybe. It makes sense that it would help a person to know not only like what to look for, but like what to focus on and potentially how to react to certain things. I mean, you never actually know how you're going to react in a moment like this. So the fact that she was able to do something that badass is all thanks to her. Like, she's so cool. But it is very interesting that she's like, yeah, I mean, I've listened to a ton of true crime and that's why I was able to remember so much about my attacker because I was able to focus in on those little details. It makes sense.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Detective Clausing was optimistic that this sketch they created would bring in tips because it was that good. But unfortunately, they got nothing from it. They took the knife from Melissa's car as evidence and processed it in the crime lab. There was blood on the handle still, which most likely was Melissa's. They also assigned an officer to go to the park, and there they found sunglasses and a roll of ventilation tape called Inner Tape 698, which is like duct tape, but it's much harder to get apart. That led them to believe that this attack wasn't supposed to just be a robbery. The guy hadn't demanded any money or anything from Melissa. And something else very notable was he didn't hide his identity from her. He wasn't even wearing a hat. Why didn't he care if Melissa saw him? Was it because he didn't think there would be any witnesses left after the attack? Was he planning on kidnapping her? At this point, the police believed that was the motive. They thought he either wanted to kidnap or murder her. Thankfully, though, Melissa had been extremely strong and fought him off, which saved her life. When Jesse's friends heard about the attack in Richfield, they felt like it was related because they live in a small town and things like this just don't happen there. 4 days after Melissa's attack, on Thursday, July 16th, Melissa walked investigators through the park to show them where the attack had happened. And she mentioned the car the guy was driving had been a blue minivan, which on its own probably wouldn't have been the biggest piece of evidence, since it wasn't an uncommon car. But one specific officer heard that that was the car they were looking for, and the case cracked open. So this was a kind of crazy part of this case. So Officer Andrew Meyer was assigned to do routine checks of the parks in the area, and he'd stop into Richfield Historical Park at least once a day. He said Richfield Historical Park is not a very high traffic area at all. Like, if he saw three cars in the parking lot at one time, it was a very busy day for this park. And because he was there so frequently, he started to notice which cars were there regularly and which ones weren't. And about 2 weeks before the attack, on one of these routine checks, he happened to notice a blue minivan at the park, which was not one of his usual cars. So he decided to run the plates and do a background check just to see who it belonged to. Nothing alarming popped up when he ran the plates. There was no criminal history, no red flags, so he figured the owners were probably just out on a walk that day, and he moved on. But when he heard that the person who attacked Melissa had been driving a blue minivan in Richfield Historical Park, he was like, "Hang on, I ran the plates of a blue minivan only 2 weeks ago in this park. Do you want the information for that car?" And Detective Clausing was like, "Hell yeah, I do. Thanks, Andy." So with that license plate, they found out the car belonged to a couple in Richfield, Laura and Melvin Bartelt. They were a local couple, so officers paid them a visit. And when they got to the Bartelt house, they asked if they owned a blue minivan, and they confirmed that they did. Their son used it. They had a 20-year-old son named Dan. So Detective Clausing called Dan and told him that he was investigating an incident that happened last Friday and was wondering if he could talk to him. Dan told Detective Clausing he would be there in 15 minutes, and he hung up. Detective Clausing immediately realized Dan never asked what this was about. And he felt like, holy shit, this really might be it. Also, the composite sketch that had been drawn up based on Melissa's description looked a lot like the photo of Dan they had gotten from his parents. So things were already starting to line up. Seems like this guy had no chill, because police call him, and they're like, "Hi, we're investigating an incident that happened last Friday." And any normal person who has nothing to hide or knows nothing about what they're talking about would say, "Huh, what happened?" But he didn't. He said, "Be there in 15. That day was July 16th, which was the day after Jesse Blodgett's murder. Some friends had been invited to go over to the Blodgett house to show support and be there for Jesse's parents, who were, of course, beside themselves, especially since Jesse was an only child. So Jessie's house was packed that day. It was full of people who loved her and loved her parents. Jessie's parents felt so touched by that group of kids, and they all sat together in the living room around the fireplace talking about Jessie. They held each other and cried and mourned her loss, but they also laughed. Jessie was such a light in all of their lives and was so funny. They were talking about all of their beautiful memories with her. And Jessie's closest friends were there, along with her ex-boyfriend, Dan Bartelt. Dan was Jessie's first boyfriend in high school, and for a time, she was head over heels for him. They dated for about 3 months, and then Dan broke things off. But they stayed really close friends. Jessie and Dan hung out all the time. They laughed constantly and also made a ton of music together. Dan was also very in the music scene. They sat next to each other for 4 years. They were first and second chair violin in the orchestra. She and Dan also did the plays and musicals together, and he wrote songs with Jessie. He had even been to her house, writing music with her, only a week before her death. When friends of Jessie's had gathered together at the Blodgett house, Dan sat on the fireplace with one of Jessie's friends, and she sat with her head on Dan's shoulder crying, and they held hands and he squeezed her hand in comfort. But then his cell phone rang, so he stepped out of the room. And that was when Dan got the call from Detective Clausing, and he told them he would be there in 15 minutes. He went back into the Blodgett home and told the room full of Jessie's friends and family that a detective had just called him and wanted to talk to him. And Jessie's mother told him not to worry because they probably wanted to talk to all of Jessie's friends. So he asked his friends if they would drive him to the police station. And when he got there, he told them he shouldn't be long, so they should come back in 30 minutes to pick him up. When Dan sat down with detectives, they immediately told him that he was not in any trouble. They started off the conversation really casually to get Dan comfortable and talking. They asked him who had dropped him off. He told them some friends of his. Okay, cool. So where did he work? He told them Associate Engineering Corporation. Mostly he would cart around materials there. They then told him this interview had to do with an attack that happened at a park last Friday and asked him if he had been at the park that day. They wanted him to admit he had been at the park at the same time as Melissa. He told them he hadn't been at the park that day. If this was their attacker, he would still have some wounds from the fight, so both detectives were periodically looking under the table and at Dan to see if they could spot any wounds. And it didn't take long for one of them to spot a cut on his thumb. He told them he had gotten stabbed with a screw while he was at work. When he grabbed a cart to move stuff, a screw had been sticking out and it cut his thumb. Detective Aaron Walsh didn't have any confirmation of this, but he had a hunch that Dan didn't actually have a job. So he took a shot in the dark and he said, "And if we were to check with your employer, would you still have a job?" And Dan told them no. He said, "That's what I thought." It came out Dan didn't have a job for a very long time. And actually, it would come out much later that Dan never worked at Associate Engineering at all. He just told his parents he did. During the interview, he said his parents didn't know he had lost his job, which was his first provable lie. So they asked him again how he hurt himself, because it obviously wasn't at work, and he told them that he cut his thumb on a knife while he was cooking. And that was when Detective Clausing went in for the kill. He scooched in real close, and he said, quote, "Hold on a second, let's talk. Nobody in their right mind would lie about cutting themselves if it happened at home cooking, okay? What happened? Just be honest." The interview turned into an interrogation real quick, and Dan was sweating. He couldn't handle the heat, so his story left the kitchen. His response was, quote, "I've gone to the park before." And they had him. Now they just had to make him feel like it would be better for him to admit to what he had done than to lie. They had to make him feel like they were back on his side. So they told him, "You lost your job. Things aren't going well for you. We can understand that. When things aren't going well for people, they do things that are out of character." They go even further to say, "If nobody made a mistake, they wouldn't put erasers on pencils." They then upped the pressure a little bit by telling him they had blood evidence on the knife that was getting processed by the crime lab. And if he didn't tell them what he did now, it would be much worse for him later. So he admitted it. He went after Melissa in the park with the knife. He claimed he did it because life scares him, and he didn't handle it well. He left college, and he was home and unemployed, and he wanted to scare someone else. Police knew that was bullshit, but at least they had gotten a confession. They then placed him under arrest and charged him with attempted murder and recklessly endangering safety. Melissa was very grateful because before now she felt like this guy was going to come back and finish the job. Meanwhile, Dan's friends came back to the station to pick him up 30 minutes after they had dropped him off, like he had told them to, but they were told that Dan had been placed under arrest, and they were very confused, but they had just assumed that they could come pick him up later. They didn't quite understand what they had been told. Dan was also in denial, because only moments after his arrest, he asked an officer if anyone with a record could become a police officer. They told him it depended on the circumstances. That's a wild question, but yeah, he is just living in DeLulu land about what has just happened. But he's under arrest for attempted murder. He's not gonna just get out of there and have everything be okay at this point. And his arrest was quickly all over the news. His friends and family were beyond shocked. Dan Bartelt came from a good family. He went to church and was a straight-A student. He was one of the few students who had a higher GPA than Jesse Blodgett did. He was an athlete on the cross-country team, a gifted violinist, a singer, an entertainer, and was involved with theater. According to his friends, he was really funny and magnetic. He could pull in a crowd and lighten up a room. His friend group, which was the same as Jesse's, loved him. Jesse and Dan were very close at the time, and a few of Jesse's friends were even jealous of her friendship with him because they thought he was so cool and smart. He went off to University of Wisconsin Stevens Point and was there for his fall semester freshman year before he dropped out. When he got home, his father told him he needed to get a job, which was when he told his parents that he got a job at Associate Engineering, and he landed the lead role in a local production of Bye Bye Birdie. He and Jesse were really close at the time, and they were writing music constantly, singing and recording songs all the time. And Buck thought that Dan was a great kid. He was one of Jesse's friends, and he really liked him. But Daniel Bartelt was playing a part. He was pretending to be something that he certainly was not. For starters, he never had the job he claimed to have. He would get up every morning at 5:30, his mom would pack a lunch for him, and he'd say goodbye before leaving for a job he didn't have. And then he would go sit at the park. His parents had no idea he didn't have a job. Clausing found out during his initial interview with Dan that he not only knew Jesse Blodgett, but had been at her home right before he came in for his interview. When they asked who had dropped him off, he told them his friends and that he had been coming from Jesse Blodgett's house, because they were visiting her parents. After the arrest, Clausing immediately called Hartford PD to let them know. Because upon interviewing this guy, Clausing knew he was bad news. And as soon as he sees any sort of tie between him and Jesse Blodgett's murder, he's like, I am going to loop in Hartford police now, because it is not far-fetched at all to think that this guy could be responsible. And honestly, it's highly likely that it's him. During his initial interview, Detective Clausing was making small talk before getting into what happened to Melissa and asked him what happened to Jesse. And Dan told them, I think someone raped and murdered her. This was a highly significant piece of evidence, because the information that Jesse had been raped, in addition to her murder, had not been released, which meant that was information that only police and the person who had committed the crime would know. So July 17th, Dan was brought in once again for an interview, this time with Hartford detectives. Detective Richard Thickens was leading that interview. He started it off by saying he was talking to anyone and everyone who might have information that could help him figure out what happened to Jesse. Initially, Dan was cooperative and wanted to talk about how great Jesse was, because he didn't think that he was in trouble for her murder. He was one of her best friends after all. He described Jesse as someone who always wanted to help. She was a great friend. She wouldn't ignore an issue her friends were going through. She would help them confront it. He also spoke about Jesse being a tree hugger and how she ate organic food. And as he talked, he began getting emotional. She advocated against any violence against women. The weird part was, he was making the sounds and movements of someone who was emotional and crying, putting his head down and seeming like he was crying, but then he would lift his head, and there wasn't a single tear in either one of his eyes. By that point, detectives knew he had lied about having a job, and they asked him what he was doing that Monday morning when Jesse was killed. Dan said he had been out driving and ended up at Woodlawn Park. And there, he was reading and trying to write, since he enjoyed doing those things outside. Woodlawn Park was fairly close in proximity to Jesse Blodgett's house. They asked him what he thought happened to Jesse, and he claimed he had no idea. Investigators said, sometimes things happen that aren't intended. Had he ever been in a situation like that? To which he responded, they were making him feel very uncomfortable because of what they were trying to insinuate. That was when Dan told detectives if they were going to talk more, he would like to have a lawyer. So with that, they had to end the interview. What they got out of it was a little more of the potential time frame of the homicide. Officers then set out to try to find proof that Dan Bartelt was actually at Woodlawn Park like he claimed. There was one camera set up at Woodlawn Park that was pointed at the entrance of the men and women's bathrooms, the one building at the park. So they pulled the footage and did confirm that Dan was at the park that morning. He had been asked so many questions during his interview, and officers believed that he fed them a little bit of truth surrounded by a whole lot of lies, which was a lot easier for him than making up an entire story. He was actually at the park that morning, and since there was only one camera at the park, they saw him walk a little bit, but eventually he went out of frame. But he was there at 10 a.m., like he said he was. However, with the time frame of the murder, there was still between 8 a.m. and 10 a.m. that Dan was unaccounted for. So police went to the park and pulled all the garbage to see what they could find. They asked the person in charge of the park when the garbage would have been taken, and they were told the garbage would have been taken on Monday morning around 7 or 7:30. Several days had passed since the murder, so the odds that any evidence would still be in the trash can in the park at that point was as close to zero as you could get, according to Lieutenant Jim Zawicki. He said, quote, "There's being good and there's being lucky, and in this line of work, you need a little bit of both of them. This case, we got a lot of luck." And they did get extremely lucky. So the guy who ran the park said that the trash got collected on Monday mornings between 7 and 7:30 a.m. And Jesse had been murdered sometime between 8 a.m. and 10 a.m., they're estimating. And Dan Blodgett was at the park at 10 a.m. They know this. Which meant that the trash in the park had been collected that Monday morning at like 7 or 7:30 a.m. And then Dan, theoretically, if he had ever thrown anything out from the murder, would have thrown it out only hours after that trash would have been collected. And when detectives were going to the park to collect this trash that had accumulated, it would have been, I think it was around Friday. So this was somewhere around 5 days later. And they were saying the likelihood of anything being in this trash can to begin with was almost zero, but they were going to try. And they did locate something in the trash, and they called it the mother load.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
They ended up finding a frosted mini wheats box. The top was opened up on it, and stuffed inside the box was a ligature, meaning the rope, alcohol wipes, a ball gag that was homemade, made with the same type of tape that's used for ventilation systems. That kind of tape was located at the crime scene with Melissa, the ventilation tape, the one that's even stronger than duct tape. They essentially found the kill kit used in Jesse's murder. It was all the supplies this killer needed in one neat little box. But now the question was, could they connect these items to Dan? Jesse would have been killed sometime after her mother went to work at 8:30 a.m., and Dan was seen at the park at 10:25 a.m. Police believed he would have had plenty of time to dump this mini-wheats box between that time frame. And after testing the ropes, they were able to find Jesse's DNA, as well as on some of the antiseptic wipes. On the tape, they were able to find a fingerprint belonging to Daniel Bartelt. They also found a hair follicle with DNA matched to Jesse Blodgett. The only DNA in that box belonged to Dan Bartelt or Jesse Blodgett. They had him. Dan had been welcome in the Blodgett home. He and Jesse had basically spent the summer together. He was hanging out with Jesse in her home only the week before. Her mother and father couldn't quite wrap their heads around the fact that he had been arrested for their daughter's murder, especially because of how violent and calculated it had been. Dan Bartelt was charged with first-degree intentional homicide, and he pled not guilty. Detectives continued digging into his relationship with Jesse, and they found a chilling Facebook post from only a month and a half before the murder. On May 29, 2013, Jesse posted, quote, "When Dan Bartelt breaks into your house while you're sleeping to awaken you, after woods walking and spectacular music making, I'd say it was worth it. May post music later." Some people commented on this post, shocked that Dan had broken into her home, saying, quote, "People would get arrested for that." And Jesse responded, quote, "He walked into my house and then my room while I was still in bed. What a freak." And yeah, what a freak. But he was her friend. He was not someone that she was afraid of. Regardless, it was a freak move. He knew her parents and when they worked, and he knew how to get in. So looking back on that moment, friends of Jesse's started feeling like that was probably a practice run for Dan, for him to test out, could he get into the house and could he get into her room? And if he were caught, it wouldn't be weird for him to be there. He was just going to play music with Jesse. And that Facebook post was just the beginning. Detectives got search warrants on Dan Bartelt's home, van, and computer, and they found some pretty shocking stuff. Not only did they find the ropes from the cereal box and other physical evidence in his home, but they learned from his computer search history that he had a fascination with murder. He spent a lot of time researching serial killers and spree killers, and he asked questions like, how many bodies do you need to be considered one or the other? And that was also intertwined with very graphic and violent pornography having to do with bondage and sexual assault and homicide. It really painted a picture of who Dan Bartelt was, instead of who he had been pretending to be for God only knows how long. It was a horrifying realization. 13 months after Jesse's murder, Dan Bartelt's trial began. He eventually pled guilty to the charge of reckless endangerment for the attack on Melissa. The charge of her attempted murder was dismissed. But he insisted he wasn't guilty of murdering Jesse. In court that day, Jesse's friends and family were on one side of the courtroom and Dan's family was on the other. Jesse's friend said it was like a, quote, bizarro horror movie wedding. People were crying and angry. You could look at anyone's face and you would see a different emotion. And I thought that was a really interesting and sad way to describe that room. Because at one point they were dating and Jesse was, as her parents described it, head over heels for him. So she probably, at some point, imagined her wedding with him, especially because this was a high school romance. It's just heartbreaking that what should be the happiest day of someone's life in a setting like this, it's actually the complete opposite and it's a nightmare. And really is like out of a bizarro horror movie. It's awful. Although Dan's DNA was found on Jesse, he was never charged with rape. Jesse's father said their biggest fear was that Dan was going to claim it was a consensual thing that Jesse participated in that just went wrong. They knew that wasn't true, but that didn't mean he wouldn't try to say that and smear her name. The prosecution had tons of evidence. They just had to figure out how to present it to the jury. Jesse's mother, Joy, was their first witness, and she was an extremely important witness because she found Jesse that Monday morning and had also made the 911 call. She told the courtroom Jesse never kept the covers on her, and her bed was never cluttered, unlike how she found her. And when the defense cross-examined her, they focused on Jesse and Dan's friendship, trying to insinuate that he would have no reason to kill his friend. And this was an unusual case because before all the evidence came out and Dan was arrested, no one saw this coming. She and Dan did have a seemingly good friendship. Dan's family knew Jesse's family well. Daniel Bartelt's mother also testified on behalf of her son, and she broke down on the stand, which was devastating all around because Jesse's family didn't blame them for this, and they didn't blame them for testifying for him. Jesse's father said he only knew them to be a good family who gave him a good environment to grow up in. It was just heartbreaking for everyone. When questioned on the stand, Laura Bartelt did admit her son could be a bit of a liar. He would lie to her often when he was growing up, and when she found out from law enforcement that her son didn't have a job, she was surprised because he had been leaving for work every day, and she didn't know where else he would have been going. Captain Richard Thickens took the stand and testified about the key evidence they found in the mother lode, the cereal box found at the park full of everything used to kill Jesse. It was extremely damning. The tape was a big piece of evidence because it wasn't just duct tape. It was a specific kind of tape. Intertape 698 wasn't common. The police couldn't even find it at any of the hardware stores in the area, but it was located at the crime scene where Melissa was attacked on July 12th, as well as in the frosted mini wheat box. And as if that wasn't compelling enough, it was also found at Dan's house, and a whole roll of it was found under Jesse's bed with Dan's fingerprints on it. Investigators had taken a very good video and photographic evidence of the crime scene, and they clearly showed the tape that was found underneath Jesse's bed. The defense attempted to cast doubt about the tape found in Jesse's room because it wasn't initially taken into evidence. It was located about a week after they had initially searched the crime scene. They never came out and said that it was planted, but they cast doubt on the investigation. Another massive piece of evidence for the prosecution was the rope found in the cereal box. Jesse's DNA was located on the middle of the rope, and Dan's DNA was located on the ends of the rope by the knots that he made. Those same ropes had been found in Dan's house after they conducted a search warrant. It was their theory that Dan cut the rope at his house, made a knot around it so it would be a good grip for him, and then used the rope to strangle Jesse. The defense tried to explain the DNA away by saying there had been cross-contamination within the box, and you can't tell where the DNA was found on one item inside the cereal box because when the items were touching each other, there was possibly transfer from one to another. They never gave an explanation for how his DNA got in there in the first place. They just said, well, you can't really tell exactly where the DNA should have been because all the items were mixed up together and it could have gotten in different places. But it's pretty compelling evidence that the center of the rope is Jesse's DNA and the ends is Dan. Dan's DNA was also found under Jesse's fingernails, which they couldn't explain away. Based off of everything they found in the Bartelt's house and on Dan's computer, the motive was that he just wanted to kill someone. That's what they determined. Jesse was asleep at the time that he entered her room, so she never would have even had a chance to fight back. She was an easy target, and that's what he wanted. The jury came back with a guilty verdict in only 3 hours. Jesse's family felt like it wasn't a victory. She was still gone, and Dan was still lost. But justice had been served. At Dan's sentencing, both Dan and Jesse's father had 10 minutes to give their statements. Dan looked at Joy and Buck and told them the shackles and orange jumpsuit didn't make him guilty. He couldn't give them the answers they were looking for. He prayed for them, and that one day he'd be before a court that knew his conscience was clear. He said, I love you, and I'm so sorry for your loss. Which was a pile of bullshit, in my opinion. Buck said again, it was as if Dan was crying, but he never actually saw any tears. And it never felt like he was remorseful at all, because he was not admitting to the crime that he had committed. When it was Buck's turn, he mostly talked about Jesse because he wanted people to know who she was, how amazing she was. And then for the last quarter of his statement, he talked to Dan directly. He told Dan he not only forgave him, but he loved him. He hated what he did, but he was forgiven, although he wouldn't feel it or experience it until he told the truth. After everything that piece of shit did and said to his face in that courtroom, Buck still said he forgave him and said he loved him. He is a better person than I. Dan was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole, and his appeals have been denied, so it's looking like he will be serving that life sentence, and good. He is currently imprisoned in a Wisconsin correctional institution and maintains that he is innocent, which is a shame. Not for his sake, but for Buck and Joy's sake. I don't know if him admitting it would help them, because obviously he's guilty. I mean, there's no world in which he didn't commit this crime, but I don't know if him saying he did it would do anything for them. Probably not at this point, but I don't know, maybe. But he's not getting out, and I think that's a good thing. He's obviously a very dangerous person. Buck said the forgiveness came from a higher place. He didn't want vengeance. And what came out of that was a movement to end violence. Shortly after Jesse's death, Buck started the Love is Greater Than Hate project in Jesse's memory. He believes violence tends to happen a lot less in the presence of love and a lot more in the absence of love. The more they presence love, the more they absence violence. That's what he's trying to do. They've hosted events for survivors of violence and featured performances of Jesse's music. And Melissa Etzler teamed up with Buck in his mission. She's spoken out about her experience and how she is forever tied to Jesse. She's never met her, but she said they have a soul connection. Melissa Etzler said, "I will never forget sitting in the courtroom hearing such compassionate forgiveness. That changed me. And from then on, I have been determined to live through love, which, believe me, can be incredibly difficult. Love is Greater Than Hate has shown me that I can forgive others and that I can even forgive myself. I also learned that you cannot fight fire with fire. In order to see change in our communities, we need to let go of the fight and teach with love and acceptance. And as a community, a civilization, we are only as good as our weakest player. I want to thank Love is Greater Than Hate for lifting those players up and being an exceptional example of what Love is Greater Than Hate truly looks like." And I think that's really amazing. It seems like they're doing awesome work. And it's an incredible message. I'm so glad that Buck has been able to turn this unimaginable tragedy into something that is making a positive change in the world and is helping people. It's really inspiring and really amazing. Someone once said to Buck, quote, "If Jesse was a soul waiting to come into a life, and they said this one's going to be short, it's going to end bad, and it's going to be violent, but you're going to cause more love than most people ever will in their 80 years. Jesse would have been at the front of the line to jump into that life. To keep her memory alive, there's now the Jesse Blodgett Scholarship given every year to young people following in her footsteps, hoping to study music as well. If you're interested in checking out the Love is Greater Than Hate Project, go to theloveisgreaterthanhateproject.com. Jesse seems like she was such an amazing person. Just what was said about her in this last quote that I just read, that she would have stepped into this life even if she knew what was coming, knowing that so much positivity and like change would come out of it. I think it just really speaks to who she was as a person and illustrates her heart. I didn't know her, but that much is clear to me, that she was an amazing person. And honestly, this story hit really close to home for me because it felt like I knew her. I was what Jesse was in school. I was in the music department. I was in the choirs and I did the musical and the play and I spent my days after school like with my friends doing homework and making music, and I went to college for theater and my sisters went to college for music, and a lot of my friends were also like doing similar things like that as well. So yeah, I don't know. It was really easy for me to put myself in the story and like imagine that and how earth-shattering this situation really was. Like, they truly had no idea who Dan was. They thought they did, but they didn't. Like, hearing Jesse's friends and Dan's friends talk about Dan was so eerie, honestly, because all of them had such good things to say about him. Like, they were saying how cool he was and how charismatic he was and charming and entertaining and how good of a singer he was and how he just pulled people in and he was so, yeah, just magnetic. And they wanted to be around him so much. And that is just so far from who he actually was. So it's just shocking to know that this girl who was doing all the same things I was doing and the same things that my friends were doing and was a really good kid and got into no trouble at all was just hanging out with a dangerous person, a wolf in sheep's clothing, like to a T. And now she's gone. It's scary and heartbreaking. It's so weird. I wonder what other tells he might have had over the years that like maybe people didn't pick up on because it wasn't like such a high stakes situation. But I'm thinking particularly about in the interrogation room and in the courtroom when Dan was essentially, it seems like, pretending to cry. And he was doing all the things that looked like he was crying, like he was moving his body like he was crying. He was making the sounds like he was crying, but no tears were coming out of his eyes. Like, was he truly a psychopath? It seems like it. I obviously can't diagnose him, and I know nothing about his medical history, nor do I know anything else about his habits other than the fact that he's committed this horrific crime and, you know, the little information we have that I've now shared with you. So take that for what you will. But yeah, I just wonder if there were any other weird moments like that, I mean, or if people just chalked it up to him being like an awkward teenager at times. Like maybe he did have weird moments, but maybe they weren't clocked as, oh, he's a psychopath, because that's not the first thing you jump to. Right? Like, and it's not funny. I'm just like, I'm floored by it. I'm shocked. Like, this whole situation is so out of nowhere and so out of the blue that I truly cannot imagine having my entire life turned upside down by someone that I thought was a good person, a friend, and who was in my life so often and doing something like making music with me all the time. Yeah, it's just hard to wrap your head around and felt personal, even though it's not. But my heart goes out to the Blodgett family and to Jesse's friends and to the Bartelt family, because they lost their son as well. And they had nothing to do with what Dan did, the crimes he committed. So yeah, it's awful. But I wish Melissa Etzler nothing but the best. And I hope she's out there living her life to the fullest. And I hope she remembers that she is a badass, because she saved her life and she remembered so many details. And because of those details, she led the police to arresting Dan Bartelt so quickly after her attack. Like, damn near immediately after her attack. It's also so insane to me that that officer just so happened to run the plates of that blue minivan in the park and remembered it and said, oh, by the way, I noticed a blue minivan that isn't typically in this park. Here are the plates and the information. Like, without that piece of information, maybe they would have gotten there. I'm sure at some point they would have been able to piece together that Dan was the person behind all of this. I think they probably would have been able to piece it together from the Jesse side of things, because he truly had no relation to Melissa. It was a completely random attack. So if they didn't have that license plate, he probably would have gotten away with it. I think at some point the police would have put together his role in his murder of Jesse, because obviously there was so much DNA and everything. But I don't know, maybe not. Hard to say at this point. But thankfully, he is where he is and he's not getting out. And I think that's all I really have to say about that. So why don't we have a bit of a palate cleanser, and I'll tell you something good that has nothing to do with this. That way we can go on with our days as normal. My good thing is that I tried out a new coffee shop today, and they have really good fun lattes, which I'm excited about. And I did some work there today. And by the end of my many hours doing work there, I was like sitting at the counter by the baristas, and a barista came up to me and he said, hey, we have to throw out these breakfast burritos at the end of the day. Would you just like to have one? And I was like, hell yeah, I want a breakfast burrito. So I got a free breakfast burrito, which was awesome. And also they were like bumping some really good music. I mean, at one point they were really blasting some High School Musical, which was a lot of fun because the baristas were literally dancing and like singing along, which I appreciated the vibe, but also I was trying to lock in and do my work. So tough for that reason, but also good vibes overall, which I appreciated. So I will probably go back there at some point. I don't know if it's going to be on a day when I really need to lock in. Another good thing that I mentioned on the Patreon already is that we got a new like little audio situation. We like upgraded a little bit and we've got better quality audio happening. I don't know if you guys will even notice anything about the audio changing, because we had pretty good audio before, but really all it did was make my life so much easier in the editing department, which is another really good thing for me. It made my life so much better. So yeah, two good things. But anyway, I hope you all have a good day. Remember to take care of yourselves. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to check out all the bonus episodes we have, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you would like to share with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We also have merch that you can check out and buy at nottodaypodcast.dashery.com. We post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. We have a Twitter that is nottodaypodcast, but the TMN podcast is a 3, because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.